From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley.
And in New York City, I'm Cornell West, and this is Smiley and West.
This week, for the hour, we'll bring you Doc's extended conversation with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
I recorded it in May at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been granted political asylum. A lot has happened since our conversation, but unfortunately, his grand struggle for truth, justice, and freedom continues.
And so here now, Doc's extended conversation with Julian Assange.
Underestimate the difficulty of being in a situation like this, but strategically things are working quite well. Long ago I asked myself the question when I was in prison, was it all worth it? And I did seriously consider the answer, and I became comfortable that when you're engaged in activity where it realizes the principles that you hold dear, not the principles necessarily that the outside world wants you to have, but your inner principles, then you are living your life. And there is no other way to live but to live your own life and to try and manifest your principles in the world.
Yes.
And although this situation is difficult, and it is even more difficult for some of our other people, it's a strategic situation that we are slowly winning, and I think the outcome is something that I will be proud of.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, it reminds me so many ways of, the great W.B. Du Bois. When he's 89 years old, he embarked on a trilogy, three novels, and he said, "I've been wrestling with these questions. That this is in the ordeal of Mansart, in the character of Mansart, but it was really Du Bois speaking." He says, "How does integrity face oppression? How does honesty face deception? How does decency face insult? And what shall virtue do in the face of brute force?" Now that's Du Bois, 89 years old. Brother Julian Assange, 41 years old, 2013, wrestling with great courage, tremendous conviction and commitment and compassion with those same questions. Now, of course, our audience, I think one of the questions our audience would want to know is that given the kind of demonization of you by my government, the U.S. government, what in your mind is their strongest argument against you, just as your strongest argument against their strongest argument will come right in that second question?
There's their most effective argument in terms of effective propaganda, and then there's their strongest intellectual argument, right, which, how long does it survive after you scrutinize it?
Right, that's right.
Their most effective propaganda argument, which is false, is to imply that somehow we have exposed people to retribution and that thousands have been killed. But actually, they don't even allege this. It's quite an interesting phenomenon where a government implies something but doesn't actually state it. And then they rely upon the mass media to strip away the qualifiers. Now, for instance, back when we released Afghan war diaries, the Pentagon held a press conference stating that I personally, or WikiLeaks, might already have blood on our hands of some Afghan family or some soldier. And the mass media then immediately took that statement, dropped the "might," and removed all qualifiers, and then pushed around the world that, in fact, we had caused the death of Afghan family or some soldier. But in fact, to this date, no government, including the US government, has alleged that even a single person has come to physical harm as a result of any of our publications over the last 6 years. But incredible to see the finesse of making an accusation with a qualifier. Anything might be true, of course. And then knowing that the mainstream press will remove the qualifiers in order to make the statement stronger. Then in terms of their strongest intellectual argument, a government in a democracy is mandated by the people who have voted for it. And therefore, the decisions as to what is secret or not is the right and proper place of the government. But I think it's their strongest intellectual argument. Now, that argument falls quite quickly because we have to understand what is the lifeblood of democracy, and the lifeblood of the democracy is information. And in fact, this is it's the one area where duly elected government, and you can argue about whether the US government is duly elected, is not and should not be able to make decisions about what information people have. And that was recognized early on by the framers of the US Constitution and Madison and so on, by mandating not that the press or the rights of the people should be protected by law, but something much more significant, that no law is to be made in relation to the rights of the people to communicate. And that is because every law, every regulation, every constitution comes about as the result of people communicating. They are distillations of people communicating. They are a secondary phenomena to people communicating. So if you ask yourself, what regulates the law? What regulates mandate? What regulates constitutional change? It is regulated by the people communicating.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why I personally consider you a courageous freedom fighter is because I discern in your life and in your witness a profound commitment to democracy, of transparency, of publicity. But at the same time, I also discern a profound commitment to liberty, of rights. And I know you've got that wonderful slogan of privacy for the weak, transparency for the strong, as it were. Yeah. Where do the roots of your commitment to democracy and liberty come from, and how is it that you're willing to pay this cost, old brother?
My parents were in the theater, and from a young age, I moved from town to town to town, and across different states in Australia. And each state has a different education system, and different political views, and barracks for different football teams. And my mother was also involved in squirreling information out about the Maralinga atomic test program that the British were doing. And so this gave me an early sense of perspective, that I understood that why there was particular ways of doing things, the way of doing things was not necessarily the only way. And I was of that generation, the last generation before internet education. And I was educated by libraries, many, many different libraries in different places. And I came to understand that what makes us civil and what makes us just is education. Fundamentally, it is education. And you see that in the workers' movements in London in the early 20th century. The primary struggle is always education. It is for people to see themselves with a sense of perspective. The fight for knowledge is the fight for education. And one cannot be free, one cannot be at liberty until you understand your environment, you understand the other actors in your environment, you understand where society is heading. As to why I would care about a liberty at all, I'm not sure. Sometimes I think this is an innate attribute that some people are born with more than others. Everyone's concerned about it, but some people are very concerned about it.
Well, you're certainly willing to act on it more so than most, no doubt. I mean, I think we're here in London, and one of my heroes is R.H. Tawney, who was, of course, a Christian socialist, the Inquisitive Society's book on equality, fundamentally committed to education, but Paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A, that deep education, not the cheap schooling that goes by the name of education these days, the kind of self-cultivation, yes, and self-culture that Emerson and Margaret Fuller and others talked about. And I see you in that tradition, and it's fascinating because in one sense, it's a very traditional sensibility. It goes back to the Greeks. It goes back to Jerusalem in terms of really having the courage to stand up for your convictions in a self-critical way, but still committed to rights on the one hand, but also transparency on the other. And I.F. Stone used to tell us all governments lie. And we know all empires hide and conceal secrets usually associated with what Brother Jeremy Scahill talks about, with dirty wars, as it were. But it's a matter of just making it available, making it transparent. In your text, it was a scary text. In some ways, it's a very bleak one. If you see mass surveillance, mass control, this cryptography as the last form of nonviolent direct action echoes of Martin Luther King Jr. And you know what he means to you. You know what he means to me. Tell us something about your present reading of our contemporary situation in light of the struggle against mass surveillance, Doman.
Well, you just mentioned Martin Luther King. He was just cited in a court case about us where the Department of Justice, National Security Division, and the FBI, who are the principal protagonists against us in the United States now, have been withholding lists of our supporters and other information they've collected about us. So there's ongoing litigation trying to force them into obeying law and to handing over that information about what their activities are. And Martin Luther King was a target of the FBI in the COINTEL program. And, you know, it was revealed at that stage that America had a political police. And the political police is the FBI. And they're back into that game in a big way. Well, I encourage people to try and look that up, the EPIC case, E-P-I-C, relating to WikiLeaks. Now, in terms of mass surveillance, we are at a very disturbing time. Just 2 days ago, a former FBI counterterrorism agent came out on CNN and accidentally, it seems, let slip that all American telephone calls are being recorded, even domestically. Now, a lot of evidence is given in cypherpunks from various court cases and statements to Congress and leaks that have come out about how the US government is recording all United States to other countries' telephone traffic. So if you're in the US and you call a friend in Europe, then how that's recorded, all the email is recorded, all the SMSs are recorded. For Latin America, the telecommunications flows through Latin America, go through the United States on the way to the rest of the world where they're intercepted by the National Security Agency, recorded and indexed. And this is something that would have once been from a science fiction horror movie, but now this is not just large government departments like the National Security Agency involved, where it's been reported in the Washington Post that they intercept 1.7 billion communications per day. In mind, the population of Earth is going on 8 billion. But they're now engaged in high levels of domestic surveillance. The National Call Register, which is what they were compiling over several years, is the communications records for the telephone system of every person calling every other person in the United States. And you say, well, so what? What does it matter if the National Security Agency and its various contractor cronies and the FBI have access to all the call records of everyone you've ever called on your telephone? The issue is, and most people may not understand this, that algorithms, automated systems have been generated to pull all that data together, to instantly discover all the communities within the United States. So you have a group of people who tend to call each other, another group of people who tend to call each other. Groups are connected to groups, different activist groups, different political groups, different companies, et cetera, et cetera. And automatically, once you have that information, you can lay out the entire community and political structure of the United States. That has been done. These techniques are progressing. If you look at wikileaks.org/spyfiles, you can see that we've released details of over 100 different companies involved in this game, the prospectuses that they, secret prospectuses that they give to US intelligence agencies and other agencies from around the world, selling bulk interception gear, strategic interception gear. It's not just about Martin Luther King anymore. It's not just finding the top activists spying on them and their closest associates. It's everyone. You go, well, why would the National Security Agency be interested in everyone? Why would the FBI be interested in everyone? It's just cheaper to spy on everyone. It's cheaper to spy on everyone than particular people.
Applied right across the board.
And tactical surveillance is what we think about when we think about surveillance. A few activists who are targeted, a few drug dealers who are targeted. Strategic surveillance is just take it all. Mm-hmm. Take it all, keep it all, index it all, and make it all searchable, automatically transcribe it, lay it out automatically into clusters of communities, and then whenever you are interested in someone, you can go back in time. Mm-hmm. You can go back in time to look at, you know, all their connections and correspondence. And if you have 10 years worth of intercepts about a person, you can find something, you can find some excuse if you want one to arrest them.
For sure. We've seen that in the history of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover and a host of others.
This is you know, automated J. Edgar Hoover at a massive scale.
Not
even just the United States, but all of Latin America, most of the transatlantic traffic coming across from Europe to the United States.
But, I mean, this is Orwell on steroids, though, isn't it? This is Big Brother on steroids.
Well, we don't just have a TV that can spy us now. People are walking around with smartphones, and every smartphone is a tracking device that also makes calls. It's undreamt of that these smartphones are revealing the cell location, so down to about 250 meters. If you look at the product literature sold to the intelligence agencies, it's 50 to 250 meters each person is being tracked. Just by walking around with this, it's not that they've been individually tracked, it's a mass tracking. The other day, Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, announced that there were 1 million new Android phone registrations per day. How does he know there's 1 million per day? How he knows is because every one of those phones reports back to Google, every single one. 1 million per day. Can you imagine if the Black Panthers were getting 1 million new members per day, if WikiLeaks was getting 1 million new employees or sources per day? That's the sort of game that these big companies are involved in. And, okay, yeah, but that's just Google. It's, you know, it provides a search service, an email. So what? What does it matter if it's connected to all these phones? Well, Google has made a strategic decision to enmesh itself within the core of US establishment power, within the State Department. Eric Schmidt, together with Jared Cohen, have released a book that they're right now pushing all around the world about the future of the world and the future of the United States and what is it going to be. Jared Cohen is a former advisor to Hillary Clinton and a former advisor to Rice. The back of the book has a list of endorsements, not endorsements from Cornel West, not endorsements from Julian Assange, but rather endorsements from Madeleine Albright, from Clinton, from Henry Kissinger, from Tony Blair. It's aimed at pulling together Google as the largest new corporation in the United States with these central elements of traditional US conservative power.
I'm a spy.
I can just say this, though, brother, that I can reassure you that Martin Luther King Jr., if he were alive, would stand on the side of freedom, democracy, and liberty, and even pay the ultimate cost, as you know he did, and the tremendous cost you're paying now, and many of us are also willing to pay. And yet it means there's a different kind of red line. Looks like the red line these days is a red line defending individual rights against expanding autocratic, authoritarian, and totalitarian powers, almost like rewriting Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, middle part of the barbaric 20th century. Now we've got these very subtle and not so subtle mechanisms that extend totalitarianism and, as you say, militarize cyberspace to such a degree that we've got these voices in our bedrooms like a soldier in your under your bed, as it were.
Societies across the West have merged themselves with the internet. And the internet has also merged with societies. And you go, well, how does that affect individuals? Well, husbands and wives communicate using mobile phones, which run over the internet. They email each other, which goes over the internet. Activists coordinate with each other, which goes over the internet. Financial transactions go over the internet. In other words, the classic elements of civilian space, of civilian society, of our normal day-to-day honest human interactions and our organized group interactions are surveilled by the military. They're surveilled by the national security complex. So the intimacy that is between a husband and wife in terms of their online chats or their emails or their SMSs between each other, what's in the middle of it? Well, the military is in the middle of it. So there has been a military occupation now of cyberspace. Because cyberspace has merged with regular human society, there's effectively a military occupation of civilian life.
But given this triumph, though, of mendacity and hypocrisy and falsity, I mean, it reminds me in some ways of the old Hasidic story about the truth being put in a grave. How can the truth emerge under conditions of mass surveillance, mass control, overwhelming hypocrisy and mendacity? We got to go back to the coat skirt that the great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to wrestle with. Can the truth, can veracity ever emerge, though, brother?
The truth is hidden through two phenomena, secrecy and complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And education, understanding is needed to defeat complexity. And organizations like WikiLeaks and courageous insiders are needed to defeat secrecy. This mass surveillance, transnational mass surveillance state, we are galloping towards that. It's coming to be that they're not even bothering to keep it secret now. Mm. These are giant mass surveillance industry conferences, for example. They're barely secret now. We've gotten people into half a dozen of them, collecting their materials and so on. So they're so comfortable with it that it is unstoppable, that they're willing even not to be secret about it. So how can we fight against this? Is there any hope at all? Is it an extremely grim picture? Yes, there is. If we look, say, for example, at Correa in Ecuador, although there was a crackdown against Ecuador in relation to it giving me asylum, Correa won with an increased majority, and there seems to be a growing independence of Latin America. How can that be when there's such an increase in sophistication of mass surveillance, particularly of Latin American communications? Well, the speed of all our communications is also increasing between each other. I spoke before about 1 million new Android phones a day, yes, reporting back all sorts of details about people to Google, where they're harvestable by US federal agencies. On the other hand, that is 1 million new phones a day and people communicating very, very quickly. There's a lateral transfer of information. So yes, the mass surveillance state is harvesting, and it's the greatest theft that has ever occurred in history, the communications of most individuals in the West, harvesting them, pulling them up to those people who already have extraordinary power, are getting more. Organizations like WikiLeaks are involved in pulling information down, taking it from very powerful groups and putting it to the commons. But the largest phenomena is the lateral transfer. It's what happened in the early 20th century in London, the United States, where you had workers' collectives educating each other, teaching each other. People who couldn't, there was no formalized university education for these people, but they would write books and teach each other. What we're also seeing on the internet is massive education of individuals in the world educating each other, small organizations educating each other. And that mass lateral transfer, that mass education, has produced a time of the greatest political education that has ever occurred is happening right now, all over the world. The breaking of the manufacture of consent is happening right now, especially for people under the age of 30. And this new generation of politically educated people, where are they going to go? Well, the CIA has to hire these people. You cannot hire a person now who is talented in any field without them having had extensive exposure to the internet. And so that also means exposure to the values that are emerging as a result of the internet. And those values are values of liberty, the rights of communication. They fall out naturally from the medium. And so as a result, moles, you know, effectively our ideological moles are infiltrating every powerful organization. And that creates a check on the power of these organizations, that they must not alienate the people with inside them to such a degree that those people start throwing a spanner in their work.
But tell me what you think about this. I mean, when I look at, for example, Obama administration, the vicious treatment of the whistleblowers, the use of the Espionage Act more than any other administration, with about three uses of it since 1917. It's about six uses in the last few years, which is a way of demonizing courageous folk trying to disclose information. And yet at the same time, the distance from the Wall Street criminality, the distance from executives who involved in insider trading, market manipulation, they're sipping tea at the White House. Certainly that creates a culture of fear. When you talk about education, and we can go back to the early part of the 20th century, and back to R.H. Taney and some of the others, they always injected a strong dose of courage along with that education. What I see now is a lot of very smart people who are cowardly, who are willing to be well-adjusted to injustice. Where does the courage of a Julian Assange, of a Brother Bradley Manley, of a Brother John Kiardu, where does that come from? How do we make that more contagious?
When I was young, I had the view that intelligence was the rare commodity, and it was a delight to find that anywhere. And when I got a little bit older, I had the view that courage was the rare commodity.
I mean, a lot of Nazis were smart and intelligent, Goebbels, and a lot of white supremacists, male supremacists, homophobes, anti-Semites, anti-Arab. Some of them are very, very, very smart, but lack courage and compassion. How do we get that in the education?
The courage was the rare commodity and needed to be fostered. Fear is contagious, but courage is also contagious.
Absolutely.
And so I think, in my experience, I don't know the answer to your question precisely, but in my experience, when people see that courageous men or women succeed in enforcing their principles, that is tremendously encouraging. I mean, those people become role models, and others try and take it on. I think it's not that courage can be taught. I don't think it can be taught, but it can be followed. People have often come to me and said, Julian, you're fearless. And I say, not at all. You completely misunderstand. I feel every fear that every other person does, but I don't recoil from the fear. I understand. I try and understand the fear. And is it a legitimate fear? Is it really coming out of the situation, the real facts and circumstances of the situation, or is it prejudice? So I think through courageous thinking, you can think past your fears. And that is something that other people can follow in. And when you have encountered a number of situations where you have successfully thought past your fears, then you develop some self-confidence that you can do it again and again and again.
Powerful. I mean, you might recall in Plato's dialogue on what is courage, namely Dilakis, he makes a distinction between rashness, boldness, and fearlessness, and courage still being different. Courage may, in fact, look like those others, but it's tied to some kind of ability to look through the fear, work through the fear with a telos, with an end, with an aim. And usually, and this is what Plato doesn't add, and see, I'm a blues man, so I got to bring back memory, right? I think it has something to do with things you remember, people you remember, values you revere, tied to your memory, as it were. And when you think of your own witness right now, what memories keep you going? Which figures inspire you to be courageous as opposed to simply being fearless?
It's an interesting question. Initially, there was no figure. I had no mentor. There was no figure that I looked up to in the sense that I thought that I was close to them or could become them. That's something interesting about very, very young men, and I assume young women as well, that because you're so young, I couldn't see Martin Luther King, for example, as a role model, not because he was American, not because he was black. I could probably get past those things, but simply because he was a lot older than me. And in fact, it has only been recently where I've encountered at a deep level people who I've grown to respect, that I have seen them under fire. And I've seen the trade-offs that they have to make in their own life, that I've grown to respect them in people like John Pilger, for example, who's become a close friend. It's an interesting question you have. Can you really relate to someone from a distance if you haven't personally seen them under fire? Bradley Manning, of course, I have personally seen him under fire, where he's been in a very grim situation in the US prison system, where they tried to get him to crack using a whole lot of methods, tried to get him to crack against me personally. Only 5'2", a young man, they weren't able to make him to crack. And you hear back from his support team that one of the reasons is that the more that they pushed him, the more he saw how unjust they were, how immoral their position was. And that is probably something that I've seen in common with courageous people, that the more that they are pushed in an immoral way, in an illegitimate way, the more they instinctively push back.
And the raw stuff that goes into that kind of courage, just the sheer grit of saying, this is the kind of person I want to be. Back to Du Bois. This is the kind of integrity I want. This is the kind of decency. This is the kind of honesty.
That's
and in
right.
the end, it doesn't have anything to do with the isms. It has to do with, this is the kind of human being Brother Julian chooses to be.
In my early 20s, I was involved in a big case in Australia, and the police were trying to convert a number of people in informers. In fact, one of close friends in that case became a secret informer against me for 6 months. They tried to do it to me as well, and I could see that strategically there might be some short-term benefit in it. But then that's not the sort of person I wanted to be. That's precisely the sort of thinking I had. And it's not that I worried about, well, what will my community think of me, or what my friends think of me. It's not even that I was concerned about what I would think of me. It's that to be courageous emancipates our own character. And every interaction that we have with the world, we have through the lens of our own character. Mm-hmm. So perhaps for every person, their primary task is to strengthen and emancipate their own character, because how can they emancipate other people if they haven't emancipated themselves? Yeah. The Pentagon gave a 40-minute press conference back in 2010 to the world, demanding from the organization and me personally that we destroy everything we had ever published from the Pentagon, that we destroy everything that we were going to publish, that we cease soliciting information from US government employees. Not saying about bribing or paying, just cease asking for information from US government employees, or else we would be compelled, this is a precise word they use, compelled to do so. They set the frame on what the battle was. Destroy everything that we previously published, destroy everything we were going to publish, and as an organization, cease to exist, cease to get new information.
Right,
They lost every single one of those.
Wow.
We've not taken down a single thing we've published.
Right.
We have published everything that we wanted to publish from the US military, and we have not ceased operations.
Right.
And so that complete loss of what they defined as the war has led to a loss of face. They reissued this threat. They reissued this threat September 28th last year.
Huh.
And we laughed. We laughed. Because
we've been doing what we wanted to do.
Threats that are not carried out.
Exactly.
Inflate.
Exactly.
So we just laughed at the second one. But the humiliation. Can you imagine now the Pentagon goes to Mali or to North Korea or some other country? We demand that you da 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 da, or we will compel you to do so. It means nothing now. And that is the humiliation that they must make up. And they're focused in doing that in just two ways. First of all, they've got an insider Yeah. There's only one name on the table as an insider, Bradley Manning. Mm. Perhaps we have other sources there, but they've got one that they say that they're going to go for.
Right.
So hence the 12-week prosecution of such tremendous scale to set that example. Then they have to also go for the outside as well. And so they're going for WikiLeaks organization and me as a symbol for WikiLeaks organization.
So you and WikiLeaks would be integral to that whole...
There's three-year investigation that it's been, quote, of unprecedented scale and nature in relation to us. They call it internally a whole-of-government investigation. It's probably involved over a dozen agencies. It's under Neil McBride, the DA, the sort of the extraterritorial DA in Virginia.
Wow.
They've got a grand jury, and they've been pulling all sorts of people in. So that's their focus, to restore authority, go for simple young man inside the military, try and pump him up to be as big as possible so they can smash him down. And then also for us as the outside organization, and then me personally as the symbolic leader for the outside organization.
And
what is happening, I've been watching closely what has been happening with the FBI, because of our involvement with the FBI. Even though our case has not formally started yet, the investigation formally started three years ago, and there's been lots of subpoenas for... They've been pulling information about Google, they've been pulling information of US ISPs out of Twitter, they've been coercively forcing my friends in the United States to testify before the grand jury, even after they plead the Fifth and so on. And that has caused a number of secondary legal cases. Like, we fight these subpoenas in court, we fight to get Freedom of Information Act, so they deny it because they say there's an ongoing investigation. We fight to understand the informers and so on. And the FBI has its role in political policing in the United States it never disappeared after these church hearings, but they try to keep their head down a bit, and now it's like this.
Escalated.
They're not waiting for a reported victim, like someone to make a complaint. They're doing this political policing long before that. And they're even ceasing to, in their internal documentation, ceasing to try and make it look like what they're doing is part of a proper policing investigation. The language is starting to, they talk about people being destabilizing or something like
that. Right.
There appears to be, my lawyers say, 60% chance of a secret indictment already present for me in the United States, that coming out of this grand jury, a sealed indictment, which is secret. Yeah. And that,
so they have secret indictments without anybody even knowing about
them. Yeah. The law is that it is a criminal offense for any U.S. official to reveal the existence of a secret indictment, even to another U.S. official, unless the other U.S. official is involved in grabbing the person. So, and then the process here into the UK, they also have sealed extradition orders. So this process. So even if the Swedish case drops tomorrow, and it's looking all very good,
That's basically gone in a way.
Politically, this is almost gone in Sweden, so
That
will drop soon enough. But then, can I walk out of this embassy? No. I still can't walk out of this embassy because of the sealed indictment.
I mean, would your lawyers even be able to know whether it's a sealed indictment?
No. We have tried, according to the Department of Justice's own guidelines for prosecutors, they're meant to say whether you are the target, subject, or witness in a grand jury investigation, unless there's extraordinary reasons why they shouldn't. And they are refusing to speak at all. That there's particular, we know that it's Neil McBride, we know the people who are responsible. They will not speak. And the interpretation of my US lawyers who dealt a lot of these cases is there's only one grounds which they could have for refusing to talk about what my status is, And that is if there's been a sealed indictment, because it would be a criminal offence for them to say anything about it. So they refused to talk about it. And in terms of the staging, there's Bradley Manning case, and the criminal aspect of this massive US investigation against me is that I engaged in a conspiracy with Bradley Manning. They have about six different attacks. That I published information that they say was classified, and that therefore is espionage in the distribution sense. The problem there is that some of the European extradition treaties don't permit extradition for classically political offences, and espionage is one of them. Also, that would embroil possibly the US newspapers. They would fight against it because they also published some of our information. So they have other attacks. The other attacks are to say that there's encrypted video of a massacre, and that we broke the encryption of this video. Yeah? And that is more than a normal journalist does. And that is, I'm somehow involved in the conspiracy to liberate this encrypted information. And then another approach that we moved federal government information worth more than $1,000 across interstate lines. And so they have a number of different approaches, but however they all involve some, apart from the publishing, all involve some interaction with me and Bradley Manning. So his trial will succeed in some ways, but fail in other ways, etc. But they obviously can't charge me with conspiracy for an act which Bradley Manning is acquitted for.
Right.
Because who am I conspiring with, right?
That's right.
So we view that it will be probably the very end of the Bradley Manning proceedings, just after, that then the case against us, they've had been doing this massive three investigation, but going from the investigative phase to the prosecutorial phase, this will activate at the end of the proceedings. That said, the US has been known, there was an espionage case that came out just recently, to keep these sealed indictments secret for a long time. So the one that came out just recently, it was 9 years they kept the indictment sealed. So that's difficult. And this is why being here and being awarded formally political asylum is part of a much bigger play on our part. We know that we're not just dealing with what happens this year. We know that me personally and the organization is dealing, you know, we have a 15-20 year battle here, because that indictment, if it stays there after Bradley Manning case, they will try and serve that indictment for the next 20 years. Until the politics changes enough to stop it, they will try and serve that indictment. And if it becomes public that they have an indictment, we're after him, we're going to get him. If they start doing that rhetoric, which is what the Pentagon did, remember, they said, we're going to compel you not to do this, that there will be so much prestige involved that they can never get rid of it. They will have to pursue it forever. We saw a case in Sweden of a US military serviceman. He just went AWOL in 1982. No crime against him alleged other than desertion. And he found his way to Sweden and then hid there in a secret identity. He wasn't given refugee status or something. The Swedes stopped doing that in the early 70s. Hid there in a secret identity. Eventually it came out. It came out when I came in here, actually, that he was in Sweden, because people were looking at these sort of situations. So what happened? Within 2 weeks, US Army prosecutors, investigators went to Sweden trying to take his DNA. And that was 1982.
30 years ago.
Yeah. So 30 years, and they haven't forgotten. Why not? Because, well, if he says, hey, I got away with it. The lack of authority, the reduction in authority, reduction in prestige is intolerable. So they have to do the opposite, which is increase their authority. We never forget. Anyone who defies our authority, even if it's 30 years, even if it's a trivial thing, just desertion, we're going to get them.
My God. Well, I'll tell you, we keep swinging. I'm telling you.
In the U.S., we're getting good support in the U.S. It's solid people.
We've got to intensify, though. We've got to intensify. And we got to make some of these connections. You know what I mean? So that when people, when we talk about the new Jim Crow, what we try to do on the radio show is, you know, you make the connections. Because you begin to see...
Our strongest supporters in the U.S. are people who went through the Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah.
Because they understand what the FBI was like in that period.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Martin was against the carpet bombing in Vietnam. He'd be against Jones dropping bombs on innocent people, especially 219 innocent children. I said, but not only that, Martin would be either assassinated or in detention without judicial process because he was connected to Nelson Mandela, which is defined as a terrorist group, and based on the National Defense Authorization Act, you can't have associations with a terrorist group, be it associated forces or what have you. I said, so Martin would be, under the Obama administration, detained without process, due process, or maybe even assassinated.
It was only 1998 that Nelson Mandela was taken off
the terrorist list. Yeah. That's exactly right.
But I know, I don't want to interrupt today, but this is such a blessing in terms of inspiration.
Stay strong.
We got to march out of this place together in a few months. You let me know.
You know, being in here is important strategically. I spoke about us getting a formal asylum. That's for Latin America.
Right.
Side in a very important way.
That's right.
But this is a case against us for the past three years. It is so complex, it involves so many US departments, it is so big and so secret, it's hard for people to imagine it. One is the condition of this young soldier, Bradley Manning, in prison.
Right.
And quite well, we and his defense team have transformed him into a victim. Quite important
that's right.
You see that way.
That's right.
The other is this physical circumstance. The physical circumstance of the embassy and this, you know, it's like a fulcrum with all these British police, that's a sort of big surveillance van out there.
Right.
And, you know, events in terms of, you know, the balcony or people coming in or out. We had a joke for Christmas we should send 12 Santas in and 13 out. And then they would arrest the 13th Santa.
Oh my God.
The handcuffs.
You can catch me weeknights on my TV show on PBS.
Smiling West is produced by SRP Productions and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. The views expressed on this program are very much our own and do not necessarily represent the views of PRI or this station.
Our producer is Joe Zephyr and our engineer, the legendary Johnny Morris.
In New York City, I'm Cornell West. Stay strong, my brothers and sisters of all colors.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.